Speaking of reliability, friends talking about reliability engineering topics. Let's discuss how to create and improve your reliability program and your career.
Hello, welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Kirk Gray.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg. Hey, Kirk. You know, we're using Skype, right, to do the recordings?
Yes, we are.
Right?
And it's a great system.
And today it's been working great.
Yes.
But every now and then it doesn't.
No, you're right.
And troubleshooting it, you come back, you know, a little while later and we try to sort out, or I go back and do some test calls. It works great.
Right.
It's so frustrating. It also realizing it's magic, right? We've got microphones and computers and routers and servers. And
that's right. Lots of subsystems in between you and me. Lots of service providers that we depend on.
Yeah.
Like DSL for me.
Yeah. And I've got cable, but it's amazing
right.
that stuff works.
We're actually going through two different, totally different systems. I'm in, you know, copper wire, you're through the Comcast or some cable system.
Yeah.
And yet we all merge and get together.
That's right. And you're on one of those funky white PC boxes of some sort. I imagine, I don't know if you're on a Dell or not.
Yeah.
But
I'm not a fanboy yet. No.
Right. Yeah. Someday. But, you know, one of the things, and I wanted to bring it up, is one of the things I've run into with a couple of clients recently is two parts. One is we're running a test on our product. We have a prototype and we see it once and then we can't figure out how to make it happen again. Or we get something back from the field. Customers, you know, has evidence. Hey, it's not working. It just doesn't work in our circumstance. And you get it back in the house and you can't replicate it. It just
right.
seems to be fine.
Right.
And in both cases, I said, you know, those are symptoms of what I would typically call an intermittent failure, where it fails under some specific conditions sometimes. So it's
right.
You have to hit everything just right and... you know, it still might not always happen. And so I said, you know, those are difficult. Now, I also caveated it with every failure is gold, right? You need to understand if you see something, especially in an early development stage, and you got like two prototypes,
right.
You see something wrong, that's gold. You just need
absolutely.
To understand.
Absolutely. That's the most valuable information you have.
That's right.
And whether it's the fact that you know, you've got the customer misusing it or whatever, you need to find that out. And it takes extra expense to do that. That's
mm-hmm.
why a lot of times it's not done. Or if the product is low cost, you know,
yeah.
it's, again, if it's a $5 product, your failure analysis is going to cost way more than $5
right.
to find out why it's failing.
And if you have 100 things coming back and 95 of them are, oh, it's, you know, issue number 1, 2, and 3, and it's pretty clear. And then I got these
right.
tail item that's a small percentage, but an intermittent. And
right.
it's diff. But at the end of the day, it is something we face, right? At some point, these intermittent failures are things that we
mm-hmm.
really, especially if they have really bad consequence, you need to deal with and you solve it. Now, when you,
right.
when in halt, right? Or in,
mm-hmm.
you're putting your product.
Stress, any environmental stress test. Yes.
Right. You're putting it under some stress and
right.
you see a blip. Now, one story I had, it was amazing. And it brought home to me why you really got to pay attention. But it was a technique thing that I learned from Mike Silverman. Is he just absolutely stressed. And I'm sure Greg Hobbs did the same.
Yes.
You have to continuously monitor, you know, run a test loop.
Oh, absolutely.
Constantly
right.
run the
system. Yes.
It's not put it in the chamber and run the temperature up and then pull it out and test it. No.
No.
It's got to be in situ. You got to run it in the place. And so
right.
we did high temperature. Everything's
right.
fine. And my technique is always wait until the engineer sitting next to me starts to get little beads of sweat on his forehead. And they go, all right. Well, let's back off and let's look at another stress. And we went cold and it was fine.
No, I send them away. I tell them, go away. I'll come back. I'll get you when.
I try to find out where they think their margins are. You know, they'll tell me one thing, but then I watch them to when they're really nervous. And yeah. And then I know that I'm getting close. And then we take smaller steps, for example, we do stuff like that.
But sometimes you see their surprise that, wow, I didn't know it could do that.
Exactly. That's very, very common. And so we're going into thermal cycling. And yes. the test routine was running on, and it was an electronics box. And at 22 degrees C, all of a sudden went dead. We were monitoring the performance. We had some signals that we were watching, and it just blipped right off.
And wait, 22 is about room temperature, Fred.
Yeah, I know. But
that wasn't a stress.
No, but it was in a thermal cycle. So we're thinking, okay. What's going on?
Oh, when it's coming back there.
It was coming from high temperature down to low, okay. And at 22, okay. it blipped. And at 18 degrees, it came right back on. Right, okay. Before we got to, like, what was that? Did we see that? What's the log show? What's going on there? Is the temperature still going down? It came back alive.
Right.
And then we went down to like minus 30, and it was just fine. And then we cycled back up. It was fine, all the way high temperature. And you're like, what was going on there? We still don't know what happened. And it came back, and we're doing, I don't know, like five or six cycles, and it came back through, and it failed again at 22 degrees.
Right.
And we're like, what in the world's going on? So then we start, something's happening here. And the ambient in the room, I think, was 25, and it worked fine at 25.
Yes.
And so we put it back in the chamber, put it at 22 degrees. And it was running fine, and then all of a sudden went off. And we found that it was one of the subroutines in the test circuit, the test software, that we just got amazingly lucky that as it was slewing down in temperature, that routine was running when it was at 22 degrees, and it ended up being a timing issue. That was at that specific temperature. And it was like...
Exactly, Fred. Now, you just brought up something that I covered in my book, our book, about thermal. No, thermal skewing.
You need to promote it more than just your book. You got to say what it is and make sure it's in the notes and stuff.
Okay, it's Next Generation Halt and Haas, Robust Design of Electronics and Systems. And that was written by me and John Paskowitz. Yeah. Anyway, I cover it in one chapter because I think that it's software, especially timing issues, and it has been shown. And I actually present a case study from a company in New Zealand about finding high-speed software intermittent problems. And I actually cover that in chapter 8, Halt Benefits of Software Firmware Performance and Reliability. But this is where I say that high speed cooling and heating of a circuit board may reveal things, because as the components, of course, all have different mass and thermal masses, that as you're blowing and transitioning in the temperature across the board, especially in a high speed, high airflow, typically what's called a Halt chamber, that does a rapid change, that you're going to get some skewing, differential skewing, depending on the thermal dissipation of each component and things like that, especially in digital systems. We know that as we cool something, the electron mobility speeds up. As we heat something up, we actually slow down, increase the resistance, impedance in wires and other components and speed signals. So we can actually skew some of the signals and the differential. We know that there's going to be variation in each digital component. It's not going to be exactly. They're never, you know, we brought up variation in manufacturing. And semiconductors, certainly such as a CPU, they can't produce, you know, 3.8 megahertz or gigahertz chips. They have to go sort through them. So there's a variation in most very complex semiconductor manufacturing that is controlled to an extent, but not necessarily as tightly as the manufacturer. So they still bend and do, say, for Intel or AMD, they still have to sort through each wafer and pick out which chips are the higher speed ones and which ones are the lower, you know, or say lower. And they use special algorithms for that to know that, you know. But so when you high what happened maybe with the product that you were talking about is when you heat and cool, you're actually heating and cooling the components at a different rate because of where they're located mm-hmm. in the device, what airflow, what cooling fans, whatever. But it can show that certain variations of parametrics of those chips, and it would, and to me, thermally skewing that timing is a very, very subtle. It doesn't take much, and it's a very tiny shift.
Yeah,
you're not shifting things significantly. So mm-hmm. you look at it from that standpoint that the thermal shifts may simulate or stimulate the variation that you're going to have when you're using certainly a single source, but even more so when you have second source components mm-hmm. and you have to do it like in a PC manufacturing, you have to use second sources because you don't have the volume. So of any one supplier.
Well, sometimes. One of the things I ran into years and years ago is a colleague of mine, we were looking at a circuit board that had intermittent problems with it.
Yes.
And so it was a prototype and the design team said, hey, you guys didn't build the proto right. Mm-hmm. It was easy to blame manufacturing. We of course blame design. If it would have been a good design, they wouldn't have had problems, but you know, I digress. And so what we did is we had the board powered up on a bench and we're mm-hmm. monitoring output and then he just, he had it like a stylus. You know, think of a pen with a soft tip on mm-hmm. it. And he just touched the various components and just put a little bit of pressure on them. Not a lot, mm-hmm. but right. He says, what are you doing? He goes, I'm looking for cracked solder joints.
Right? Yeah.
If it cracks and it's open right now, a little pressure will lead it. And then he got it like a little pick out that was insulated and just, and a lot of the leads were gull wing leads on the bigger components. And he just lifted them a little bit and we were still watching. And so it was kind of a tedious process, but we were looking for connections that were bad.
Yeah. And I use a etching pen with a etching pencil, you know, a little rubber, put a pencil eraser on it and that provides a pretty good little vibration source.
Then he got a little can of little canned air, you know, you spray like a keyboard to clean out stuff and it's
free spray.
Mm-hmm. Free spray and it's cold. And he would just spritz a few of mm-hmm. the different little components and they would change their temperature some. And then I thought, well, how is he going to do the temperature one? And he had a hair dryer thing. Mm-hmm. It was an industrial one, but it had a really small nozzle on it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it whistled horribly. It's pushing a lot of air through a small hole.
Right.
But he would heat up. And in that process, he found like three or four different things that could have contributed to the problems that we're seeing.
Right.
But it was, it doesn't take much because he would hit it with the air and it would be, you know, just a psh, like that. And bang, the circuit would lose memory. And it would like, where'd that go? And it'd cool up warm up a few seconds later and memory's back.
And that's a way to isolate the component that you're thinking is having the most effect on the circuit. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in this case study that I did put in the book, it shows that they used a little Peltier device, a little thermocouple. It cools and heats electrically.
It's just a little hot.
It's a Peltier device. Okay. And they would use that to put it on certain components mm-hmm. and heat and cool.
A bit more control than what I was doing.
Had more control. And then they would use a power resistor to heat mm-hmm. and they could control that a little better. And that's how they found out the weak mechanism. I've done this too. I've actually had to, in a case where I had two portable computers that had been sent back from the field in totally different locations of the world. Mm-hmm. And they both reported the same problem. And so, and they'd been tested for 5 days sitting on a bench running software, you know, routines mm-hmm, mm-hmm. to verify its function. And the OEM that was doing it had said that we can't find any problems. So I said, well, give them to me. I would like to try some stress on them. I put them in a chamber that I'd already had set it running minus 10 to plus 65, which I knew was a safe range for this particular portable computer. Mm-hmm. And when I came back the next day, it was going from a thermal cycle about every an hour and a half up and down. And it came back the next day and both systems were locked up, showing the same failure, essentially what we believe was the same reported mode of failure.
So your customers were trying to use these in thermal cycling?
No. Yes. See, that's the thing, Fred. It happened to them intermittently in the field, mm-hmm. but we stimulated it through thermal stress for this marginal condition to occur in the 24 hours. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sitting it on the bench was not going to be – well, it was obviously – these had been on 5 days, 24 hours a day,
running,
been cycling.
Running.
And then they do fine under one condition. But, again – you know, you're talking about a product that goes worldwide in all kinds of conditions, humidities and environments. And so,
well, think,
you know,
about,
it's going to.
Well, think about Houston, Texas, right? You're in a building and your meeting's in the building across the street, and you're going from 20 degrees C. You walk out the lobby, it's 85, you know, it's 40 degrees C and humid, and then everything condenses, and you walk back in the other room and it cycles way back again.
And, you know, as I write about, that changes even humidity, especially as we get into higher frequencies that mm-hmm. we are now into in microprocessors, things that were, you know, third, second and third order could be problems are coming first order problems. Just like in the FR4 material, the amount of humidity or a moisture that it absorbs affects its impedance and affects the crosstalk and affects, you know, a lot of things. And so that factor could be, you know, as we get them to higher speeds, they all become more possibly sensitive to those variations in the manufacturing process. And what I find very interesting in this industry and just amazingly absent is the interaction between software and hardware variation. Software has no, you know, let's say software doesn't have variation. You apply the same instructions to every unit. But hardware does have much more variation, mm-hmm. and there is no study in signal integrity in the variation. I have not found it when I researched my book. Maybe somebody's looking at it. But we know hardware affects the signal integrity, and variation in hardware will affect the signal integrity, whether it's the plating process, the vias, cracked vias, the amount of thickness, the, you know, the different layers mm-hmm. of a circuit board now up to 6 or 16 or, you know, who
more,
knows,
yeah.
more, that all of that is so, you know, very complex that the best, I mean, the most efficient, I think, way of doing it is doing these, and this is where I don't normally think of thermal cycling for HALT. Normally, when I began in HALT 25 years ago, whatever, it was really, and I still think the most important thing is to find the boundaries of strength, yeah. operational and sometimes destruct limits. But in digital systems, destruct limits is not relevant because it's usually causing, you know, you're up the free flow.
Right. Yeah, it's a bigger
so
problem.
You don't go beyond its operation. It, but
and I agree with you. It's the thermal cycling. But I agree with you, Kirk, because the thermal cycling is it's not a big deal usually. I don't find all that much in it.
No.
Yet I always make sure we do it, especially in electronics, because it gives you that differential heating and cooling. Just as you explained, different components have different thermal masses, and it's one way, it's not the only way, to force these little timing issues or these little signal integrity right. type stuff and so on. Now, let's go back to what's the best way, right, of finding an intermittent fault? I mean you're doing everything you're doing, right? They're doing prototypes, they're doing a range of different mm-hmm. just on the bench, we're just trying to make sure it works. We're doing performance measurements. We're doing all these other things. So my opinion is the best way to find intermittent is that when one happens is you have to notice it.
Right.
Right. You can't just say reboot, start over and ignore it. Something happened that caused
this
glitch.
And maybe just milliseconds or you know, nanoseconds. You know, it may be a very short event. Yes.
That's right. But you can't just like, oh, I'm under the gun to get this other performance measurement made and it won't. Mm-hmm. And I had a glitch on the boot up, so I rebooted again and it worked fine. Mm-hmm. At that point, and I know this firsthand, I've been in this situation, and I've seen plenty of others doing it, is that I have a mission, I have a deadline, I got to get this done, and I drive on, and I'm like, oh, why did it do that? I don't have time for that.
Right.
And I go on.
But or, that's your most valuable thing.
That's right. And the other part is, though, it's so hard to recreate that problem. So I think the first thing is just notice it, right? And then right. log it, put it in the Fracas right. system, tell somebody about it. If you don't have time to solve it, you still need to make it something. Because if 15, and I was in a lab that we had 15 prototypes, every single prototype had this problem at startup. Everybody had to reboot it twice to get it to start. And I'm like, but nobody reported it. And I was running it, and I mentioned it.
Because all you had to do is reboot it, right?
Yeah. And it wasn't what we were testing. We weren't testing the boot up routine, right? It's a prototype. We know there's problems, blah, blah, blah. Just, and every one of us made that independent decision to ignore it, right? Mm-hmm. And some of us didn't even do it consciously, I'm quite sure. And so I brought it up in a meeting. This is like, yeah, no, I did notice that it took two startup routines to get my tests going. Did anybody else see that? And everybody in the room did. And I'm like, that's a problem, guys. I don't know what it is, but who's going to work on that?
Right. Was it, 100% of the product? That would be a problem.
Yeah.
But if it was some products weren't, some units were not needing the doubled cycle.
Oh, no, it was every one of them we had. And we were able to reproduce it.
Yeah, there you go.
Every time we went out and said, all right, let's pull one in the office, and we booted and it didn't boot. We did it again, and it did. And our main theory was that the initial boot warmed it up a little bit, but not enough to get it to go. And the second boot got it up the next bit of temperature, and it some interconnect or something didn't like it being at 25 C. It had to be at 30 or 35 C for it to work. And then it took a bunch of work to figure out what in the world was going on. And of course we blame software. It was always their fault.
Of course. And the hardware guys blame the software guys. Yeah. Of course. It's the way it works.
It's the way it works. Yeah.
So maybe why it's never been studied between the interaction.
That's right. There's plenty of blame going.
Wait, they don't want to divide it up to maybe it's both,
Yeah. So if you're listening to this and you happen to have a software engineer or two on your team, you can always blame them, right, for these intermittent things and then go on for it. But I think, what Kirk and I both related a couple of stories about types of intermittence we've seen and how we've noticed them. But the underlying main point here is that when you get an intermittent, you have to pay attention to it.
Try to find
the cause. And that gets trickier. We talked about a bunch of ways to go about doing that. And so if you've got, this kind of situation and maybe a couple other ideas about how to find these things and to reproduce them, we'd sure love to hear from you. And head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and you can join the conversation there. And like I said, we'd love to hear from you. So, Kirk, you got any intermittent failures you're working on today?
No. I'm doing fine here. No blenders broken, and we'll see.
No circuit breakers.
No circuit breakers fail. All the things we've talked about over the many years that we've been discussing and speaking of reliability. But there's always something more to discuss. So thank you all for listening, everybody, and please. Please provide as much feedback as you want, and we really enjoy that, seeing your comments.
Yeah, well said, Kirk. All right, we'll talk to you again. Cheers.
Okay, bye.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.